time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com. I'm Paul Daly, here tonight with my wife, Caroline.
Hi, guys.
And we are here to talk about the first episode, the pilot episode of the new series, Fear the Walking Dead.
Many of us have been following Walking Dead for years now, loving it, coming up on the sixth season. So we were elated to hear that there would be a companion series put out this year.
Fear is meant to be a quasi-prequel. It's not a prequel to the story of the characters, but it is a prequel of the Walking Dead universe itself. Like the same, okay. For whatever reason, there's a zombie outbreak in this show. It's the same reason as the other show.
What would you consider that? It's not a spinoff. It's not anything. It's like just like a sister show.
Calling it a companion.
Oh, companion is the right. Look at me. I hadn't even heard it. And I said the right word.
Right.
Wow, your nerd biz is really wearing off onto me.
It's very thorough. I've been doing a good job on you. So why don't we just talk about the pilot?
I am not anyone who has watched a lot of zombie movies. So I hadn't gone into The Walking Dead nor Fear with a lot of information about how do most zombies come about or what is the ways to kill them or those types of things. I didn't know until Walking Dead anything really about zombies.
I have seen many zombie movies and I've read many zombie books and I have seen all the different permutations of zombie origins, zombie rules, everything possible. I've seen some variation of it, I think.
So going into this show, what did you feel about zombie lore and how this was going to fit in?
Having seen every episode of the first series, they did not explain the origin of the zombie apocalypse. It's my thought that unless they explain it in some way in this series, we'll never know. Because at the end of the first season, in the first series, the CDC blows up. And the last guy that was working there wasn't even their best guy. And he didn't know. He just knew that everybody was going to become a zombie when they died. That was the best he had. It's unlikely that we'll ever find out unless they tell us.
Do you think that Fear will tell us? What do you think?
No, I think they'll imply.
Shoot, you really don't think? Oh, man.
Well, we have.
I was really hoping for a clear cut, like, you know, somebody got bit by a monkey in the jungle or, I mean, something. I really was hoping for something.
I have some suspicion that either they're giving us a hint or they're just playing with us, given the way that the show opens.
Okay, so let's start with what is the zombie prevailing theories and which one do you kind of like hitch onto and why do you think that this goes right into the beginning of the series?
Do you want to know my own personal zombie outbreak theory or do you want me to know just how it jives with the show?
Okay, let's start with your personal zombie outbreak theory, but then I want to really understand, like, what is a very common theory that you think really goes on right with the show?
Most modern zombie stories are some evolution of a chemical or biological outbreak, normally a weapon gone wrong kind of thing. And I don't think that's what's happening in The Walking Dead, though.
Historically, there are many zombie theories out there, right?
The first zombie stories were actually not dead bodies coming back to life, but more like controlling another person. And that's from Haiti. The Haitian zombie is actually more like mind control.
Okay.
What happened in movies was kind of a derivation between Haitian zombies and a Middle Eastern story of things being brought back to life.
Okay.
And that's what George Romero did in The Night of the Living Dead. It's that origin story that I think we're getting a nod to with this opening scene. The catchphrase or the pitch for Night of the Living Dead was, when hell has no more room, the dead will walk the earth. I think that with the opening scene, if we're not getting an admission that that's the reason they're going to go with for the zombie outbreak, then they're at least giving a nod toward that origin story, kind of an homage, if you will, kind of a backhanded way to do it.
So what does it mean if, in that case, how do you interpret that phrase, when hell has no room, Does that mean that anybody who's going to die and go to hell, they're not going to walk the earth? Or just means like heaven and hell, everything's full. And now everything's coming back to life.
Well, to be fair, when they made the movie in 1968 or whenever it came out, saying hell in an ad was a pretty good way to get people's attention.
Does it just mean like the afterlife is full?
Yeah, they're done taking souls. And that's it.
Okay. So launching right into our first scene, we're in a church setting, which automatically goes back to that thought that you were telling me about hell being full. And so I thought religious context right here, like right away with Nick waking up in a church and looking for his friend Gloria, which we looked up. And if she was like 18 years old, that would have been a very unpopular name of the day. So Gloria was kind of an unusual name.
Very deliberate choice.
We thought so. Yeah, for sure. And so calling out for Gloria and ultimately finding her eating the face off some guy.
You couldn't help but kind of read into the symbolism of having an abandoned church or a church abandoned by its congregation. And Gloria, whose name is a part of a recitation in church that is glory to God in the highest, and eating someone's face in this abandoned church, you couldn't help
pretty wicked.
But kind of develop this opinion that if God's abandoned by man, then he's going to go all the way with that idea, I guess.
Yeah, so maybe God abandoned man back.
Right.
Got it. Huh. So Nick is sort of this Johnny Depp lookalike, old school Johnny Depp with kind of stringy hair, super skinny body, and very distractingly.
Scissor hands variety.
Totally scissor hands. Distractingly wearing like a woman shrug. When he sees Gloria biting the face off this man, he takes off running. He's got his Forrest Gump feet on. He takes off. That was very, very believable how fast he was running, dead into traffic. And they did that awesome Hollywood thing where first he gets buzzed by the motorcycle or moped or whatever. And then you think like, ooh, that was a close one, just to be like, bam, like smacked by the car onto the windshield.
It was startling.
And for the first, like, that was only the first, what, 3 or 4 minutes of the show?
Three, yeah.
We've got a face eater and getting hit by a car. So it's pretty dramatic.
I've totally bought into the run. I thought that that was as scared a run as you could possibly do.
Much better than the standard horror movie, like, oh, like I step 2 steps and I fall over my own feet. And then I start doing that backup scoot on my butt instead of just standing up and running again. Like, those movies always make me want to pull my hair out. He legitimately got away.
Cinematically, we saw that this scene was in slow motion. The only reason I bring that up is because they use it throughout the episode whenever they show Nick. Nick's the only one that gets slow motion. This is the first of like 3 times we see slow motion with Nick. And I kind of wonder, in this scene, we know that he's waking up from something. And I wonder if the slow motion is just part of kind of diminishing his reliability as a narrator. Like, it's like his perception is in doubt.
Yeah, right from the get-go, I felt very uncertain. It was pretty clear to me that we were in some sort of drug den of some sort. And they set him up as kind of high or at least confused, hungover, drunk, something. So when we see Gloria like that, I'm very uncertain as to, you know, whether or not he's just hallucinating, and which kind of makes sense. I mean, this is the very beginning of a series. I don't know why we would jump directly to a zombie in the very first scene. Seems like we might build up to that. So really no idea if Nick is really seeing a true zombie incident here or not.
I thought that he was seeing a zombie. I just wish that they had done a little more to make it questionable, make it a little more swishy or swirly in the way that he was seeing it, not so crisp.
Yeah.
Something that would have lent to the idea of a,
like, leaving a question in our
possible
minds.
Hallucination. I think that would have made it, in a series where suspense is going to be hard to manage since we all kind of know where it's headed.
Right.
I think they need to help themselves out by building in some suspense here and there.
So we head on to the next scene with a woman getting ready in the morning. The house is kind of messy, and we learn that her name is Madison Clark, or Maddie, and she's the mom to Alicia, who's getting ready in the morning as well. My first impression of Maddie wasn't very good. I wasn't relating to her as a mom. And she just came off like one of those women, and maybe listeners, you'll kind of understand what I mean when I say this, but just sort of like one of those women who don't have women for friends. She just seems like one of those women who is like a little too curt, a little too brash. I'll swear with the best of them, I don't have issues with that, but there's just this certain kind of girl who just doesn't seem to ever have any girl pals. And she just comes off like this kind of girl who is just going to steamroll over a lot of people. And I don't know. I didn't click with her very well. I don't like her yelling, you know, ass and stuff at her kid. I don't know. It's not my thing. The next character we meet is Travis, who appears to be married or at least in a relationship with Madison. But it's pretty clear pretty quickly that we don't really think this is kind of a newer kind of relationship, it seems, or something. This dynamic is new. And the phone rings. And they all kind of stand there. And this part was really odd, how they just sort of all stand there very stunned.
Yeah, like there were a few beats.
Yeah, like the phone's never rung before. And even Alicia, the teenage girl, comes walking out of the bathroom like in her towel, like as if she's never heard a phone ring. So when they pick up and it turns out that this group is related to the boy Nick that we saw earlier get hit by the car, and this is the call from the hospital. Right away, Paul and I kind of were wondering right then, like, okay, had they been looking for Nick? Did they not know where Nick was or what exactly was going on? Because it seemed like they were anticipating that call in some way and dreading that call in some way.
I got the sense, and we've talked about it, and this was the wrong sense, but I still think that there's some validity to the idea that when this group gets a phone call, it's unwelcome.
Like, okay, I'll go with that. So just as a group,
they've gotten enough of them together that have been bad.
It's everybody gets a little nerved up.
That was my initial read on it.
Okay, so then we flash to the hospital with Maddie. Travis is the man who's with her and Alicia, and they are coming in getting the rundown from the doctor. And it's real clear by their conversation that Maddie has done this a lot. She's asking about the toxicology screen. The doctor is filling her in, but at the same time feeling very blown off. And again, that's kind of her demeanor, that very brash, you know, she doesn't even have really the courtesy to listen to what the doctor's trying to tell her. She kind of blows into the room, and Nick is laying in the bed with police officers around him who have been kind of pressing him for some information, sort of having this police officer versus the guy they've talked to 1,000 times and know that he knows more information than he's saying. And they just have this kind of back and forth going on. But the way that Maddie comes into the police officers, into the whole scene, again, I just found very unrelatable. I don't know, Paul and I were talking about this, and we're parents, and I understand that it was very clear to me that this was not the first time that Nick was in trouble. This was not the first time that Nick had been on some sort of drug issue situation with the police. But the way that she doesn't say anything to the police, like, you know, I got it from here, guys, or, you know, whatever. But she's just like, is he up on charges? Fine, get out. It's all, for me, like I said, unrelatable. I wouldn't behave that way, and I don't know anyone who would behave that way. So I'm not saying she should be like bowing down to the police officers or anything, but at the same time, just a little like normal amount of
respect.
Can we have some privacy, or, you know, just something like, right. Yeah, just a little bit of, I don't know. Again, this is just the part of me that was like, I don't really know this lady. And like, she is the type of person who, if you tried to sit down and have lunch with her or something, would be very hard to talk to. In the course of conversation with Nick, she says she's going to call for a bed. And this is kind of the first time that we realize, okay, so they've done this rehab route bunches of times. And, you know, he's not interested in doing that. Travis needs to excuse himself for a phone call. And this is where we learn more about him.
Travis needs to talk to someone that's probably an ex-wife. It's dad weekend coming up, meaning that it's his weekend for custody of their child. With all of the excitement going on at Madison's house,
I think she wanted to just, yeah, make sure that Travis was available to actually take their son, because if he was all wrapped up in this Nick business or whatever was going on, then maybe he wouldn't have time. But
we find out that the son isn't really interested in putting in the effort.
He seems to be like, how old would you say? Like maybe 15?
Somewhere in the middle teenage years.
Yeah, so he got on the phone. He was super not interested. But, I mean, Travis kind of, you know, shows that he's maybe a good match for Maddie's like, fine, keep him. not interested. So he doesn't play these reindeer games either.
I think what's interesting about this scene and the preceding scene back at the house was that we get a feeling for Travis and where he is in this relationship with Maddie, and that I think he's still kind of at the beginning, the I'm going to impress you and go all in and make hard choices that prioritize you and your family. And like he was fixing the plumbing before work, he comes to the hospital and then he tells his son to buzz off.
We're definitely being set up to view him as more the caretaker and more the one who is the kind of the softer heart, the more caring person. He does encourage Maddie to go off to work. You know, she turns out to be a guidance counselor at the high school, and she has important stuff going on that day at school, and he can get a sub. He's a teacher as well. He stays. So that was super interesting that Maddie and Alicia go ahead and head back off to the high school, and Travis, the really unrelated party here, stays with Nick, who is, by the way, restrained to the bed. On the drive from the hospital with Maddie and Alicia, the one thing that we see outside the window, and they kind of pan by kind of slowly, is this children's playground. And there was some kids playing, and there seemed to be quite a bit of activity, actually. You know, people are on the swings. There seemed to be, I don't know, some people exchanging packages between one another. So kind of questionable, a little weird, especially because it was like, I mean, this would be before high school starts. So in our neck of the woods, that would be like 6:45 in the morning.
Pretty early for...
The playground was bustling.
Active playgrounds.
It was bustling. So that was like a little out of place. And of course, the camera like kind of goes slow by it. Like they really draw our attention to it. We get to Maddie's place of employment, Alicia's high school. And wow, you know, we haven't been in high school in quite a few years, almost 20 years now. But man, the amount of metal detectors and police officers and everything were quite different than our high school was. So it gives some background on what part of LA they're in and what's going on with their school. They have a really awesome impersonator of the principal, Joe Clark, who's like standing there like greeting each student every day. It was a complete flashback to that movie for me. He kind of hassles Maddie a little bit, and Maddie says to him and finally explains to us that they found Nick. So that was the moment where we were supposed to understand, oh, okay, so Nick, they've actively been looking for Nick. That phone call in the morning, the reason why they were so panicked or sort of freaky faced at one another was like, this was a call that was coming in at 5:30 a.m. it must have been, if they made it all the way to the hospital and then made it all the way to the high school before school was starting. You know, it seemed like kids were still just coming in the building. So that was early that they were getting that phone call. So I guess we've all had that panicky 5:30 phone call.
We all know when phone calls come at certain times. And in this case, they were expecting news. While Maddie and the principal are talking, the metal detector goes off and we meet a young man named Tobias, who Maddie covers for and takes to her own office, where she finds that he's trying to smuggle in a paring knife.
Oh, did you think it was a paring knife? It looked almost like a letter opener.
I was watching fearstorysync.com, and they had a gigantic picture of it at the same time, outlining all of the details of it, and they definitely called it a paring knife.
Interesting. So if you guys haven't had a chance, when you're watching Fear, there is a website that you can turn on your computer or your phone while you're watching, and it shows you additional details to the show simultaneously as the show is being played. So it was really neat. Paul turned it on this time, and they would like freeze frame certain things, and
they did a few things. They took polls of what you thought of the gore level or the intensity. They showed details on like the paring knife and the family pickup truck, and they also provided these PDF documents that you could open up and read that were supposed to be like newspaper clippings and things of stuff going on at the same time as the show.
So really cool. I've never heard of a show doing anything like this before. I'm sure there probably has been, but if it's not, this was really unique to be able to kind of layer your experience. It seems super interactive with the polls, and then also really fun that you get a chance to do that simultaneously. I don't know if you're able to get it later on if you're a DVR person. I don't know if you're able to sync back in some way, but I bet not. And so if you have to watch it live, well, that's a pretty unique
feature. Because it's timed. Feature. It has a timer.
Yeah, that's super unique. I mean, how fun. So this interaction between Tobias and Maddie was a little weird for me because I was a teacher at one point, and albeit an elementary school teacher, so I wasn't dealing with high schoolers, and this clearly was a more rough high school, but I really did not like the way that Maddie spoke to Tobias. I know that she was being encouraging in kind of a gruff way, but like her actual quote was, "Don't screw yourself. You've worked your ass off." For me, there's got to be some amount of code of conduct with professionals that you would not speak like that. I mean, even if you wanted to speak more casually, you could say, like, "Come on, Tobias, you know, you've worked so hard and I really, you know, I believe in you and you can do this. You've been working your butt off." Like, I don't know. Just the way that she talked, again, it was one of those things that just like totally turned me off of her character completely.
And it was one of those scenes where, since we know Tobias is right and we see Maddie saying all the wrong things, it's meant to, I don't know, prove to us that Maddie isn't quite ready for what's about to happen.
And like kind of like bossy about it too. So Tobias is, the reason why he brought the paring knife is because he was concerned that there have been reports from 5 different states of some sort of, I don't know that they were using the word zombie. He certainly did not use the word zombie, but some sort of infection, some sort of outbreak of something. And so he was bringing the knife to school in order to stay safe. I mean, obviously, we all agree he can't be bringing a knife to school. That's not safe. That's not okay. But I just felt like the way that Maddie handled it was weird with him.
This was indicative of what we had talked about when we, Carolyn and I, had watched the available preview material that AMC put out about the show. And on one of those, one of the executive producers, Greg Nicotero, had mentioned that this show was going to outline some of the problems that just what he called the infrastructure of our society would present to somebody trying to survive. Immediately, I took the idea that he meant the army, and what Caroline took was a more personal tack on that, which was Maddie. Maddie's part of the infrastructure.
Yeah, well, in this case, so here's a young person who is trying to create some amount of possibility of survival for himself.
Right. And another story, Tobias is the star.
Yeah, and Maddie represents the infrastructure, in my opinion, in this case. And so in this particular case, she takes the knife away from him. Of course, we all would. I mean, I understand that. But, you know, in the bigger picture, people like Maddie are frustrating as anything to all of us watchers who know stuff's about to happen. We don't know how soon, whether it'll be this episode, next episode, what part of the season we'll get to see zombies true head on, like come and attack. But at the same time, when you see people who are like, "You need to just settle down." You mean, as a person who's been watching Walking Dead, you're like, "No, dude, pack your sack full of food, medicine, supplies, and like get yourself to like, you know, the safest place you can find." And it's frustrating. And I do feel like that is definitely going to be a theme of fear for a lot of people who are going to start off, especially if you've been following Walking Dead, just feeling like, please, oh my God, please, we know what's coming. Please don't be a problem. Please, you're acting. It's like the don't go in the basement kind of feeling, only worse because we know what's in the basement. Like, you know, even if in those horror movies you don't really know, but you just get a sense and you don't want the person to go in there, now it's even worse because like we straight up know what's going to happen and they're being blocked from being able to save themselves. The next scene focuses on Alicia and her boyfriend, Matt. Alicia, as you remember, is Maddie's daughter and Travis's, I guess, sort of stepdaughter, sort of, I guess. I don't know. They're just dating, I think, with Maddie and Travis. But Matt describes Alicia to herself as being super smart and that she could even be teaching the classes at the high school. And this gives Paul and I a little hope that maybe we're going to actually see a teenage girl character that isn't just this cookie cutter, gripey, grousey, completely complaining, has nothing to contribute except for bad attitude, basically. So we're really looking forward to Alicia expanding a little bit more in this series because we don't see her too much in this episode. We switched back over to Travis and Nick, who are in the hospital, and they're having conversation. Travis is really trying hard to pull out of Nick what it is he saw, why he was running, what he was doing.
Nick decides to tell him.
He seems to, right?
Where he was playing dumb, I mean super dumb, with the cops. He and Travis, he manages to tell him pretty much exactly what happened. I don't think he embellished or deviated. I think he said exactly what we saw, which is it's good that everything matches up.
Given that we know that Nick is a drug addict, it's really hard for us to know if what he saw was truthful. But he really seemed truthful in the moment with Travis in describing the scene. And it makes me think that, okay, despite the fact that there could have been some sort of hallucination or he was hungover or drug out, whatever, I'm not sure, it seemed legitimately like this is what he really saw and that it was real.
Travis doesn't want to believe him because it sounds horrible and unbelievable, but it's this kind of plea that Nick makes at the end of the conversation where he says, if that didn't happen and these are hallucinations that I came up with, then I'm insane and I don't want to be insane. Even though that's not like, you know, Shakespeare, it is good enough to get Travis to decide to go check things out for himself.
I think also, too, that the fact that we've established that Travis is a high school teacher and Nick is obviously a teenager, Travis clearly has some sort of rapport with teenagers and, you know, maybe does see a kernel there that another adult would really just pass on by.
Travis decides to go check things out at the church himself. He has to break in order to do this.
Which, whoa, crazy. I don't know if to say stupid or brave. I'm not so sure. I think crazy that he doesn't bring someone else with him.
Or
stupid he doesn't seem to have a weapon.
Or some kind of stick.
I don't know, anything. It's kind of creepy because even in all honesty, if there's not a zombie feeding frenzy going on inside, there's probably still like hopped up, you know, crazies in there, somebody that you might want to have something with you.
And in fact, he meets one. After looking around for a little while, he runs into a guy that when he gets the light flashed in his face, he freaks out. And
he starts
yelling, stop, don't kill me, don't kill me, don't kill me, and he runs away.
So clearly, though, that gives Travis the little nugget he needs, though, that somebody is running around and they're killing people. Beyond that, the bigger nugget he gets is there's pools of gooey, nasty blood.
Blood everywhere that he can find.
Disgusting.
What I thought was interesting about this scene wasn't what he saw, it's what he did and why he did it. I mean, all he had to do was go pick up his son and make him sit with the rest of Maddie's family. And that, comparatively to breaking into a drug church, is pretty easy.
Just to try to follow through on what somebody else, on what Nick says.
I mean, right.
You're right. It is very kind-hearted or stupid. I can't figure out.
Well, I was going with...
That he's really moving on with Maddie's family?
Yes. Yes, that's where I was going. Intercut with all of the church stuff is little shots of Maddie at the hospital becoming more and more upset over what's going on. At first, I think she's upset to see that Travis isn't there with him. And eventually she starts crying. And by the next scene, we see that she's actually sleeping in Nick's bed with him.
Like she's curled up next to him, which I don't think is like entirely crazy. Like, I don't know. We've stayed at hospitals before where there's not any really bed. And there wasn't in this hospital situation. There was just like a little chair for her to sit on. So it kind of makes sense that she just kind of curled up next to him and was kind of doing mom duty, you know, trying to kind of pet his hair kind of thing.
Travis and Alicia show up and Travis lets her know that she's got an hour to get ready for work. And this lets us see the first brother and sister interaction between Alicia and Nick. Up until now, everything we've seen with Alicia toward Nick has been very dismissive. She is ready for her parents to stop worrying about him.
I just think that she comes off like somebody who's just worn out by his antics and worn out by, you know, it's obvious that this Maddie-Travis relationship is probably taking a lot of energy from her mom as well. It just seems like she's just kind of ready for everybody to move on.
So they have a pretty frank discussion that Alicia takes. I'm not sure how seriously she takes it because this is probably the 12th time she's had it. It ends with a question mark that Caroline saw it one way and I saw it another, and it's worth discussing. He seems like he is done with this lifestyle, and he says that he is going to end it.
I think that the worst part of this addiction lifestyle is that dangling line between the people who are who are trying to root on the addicted person and the person who is addicted. And that like little tiny string, no matter how thin and how much it's really deteriorated, just like dragging people along, keeping them on the hook is, I think, one of the most painful parts. When he says he's going to end it, I was thinking it could be a variety of things. He means like cut it off with his family completely or end his own life.
I saw it like making a, as real as he can make it, stab at stopping his addiction to drugs. Alicia was, she was like, okay. If she also understood that he meant suicide, if you rewatch the episode and read into it, he means suicide, and then see her response. Man, is that one cold-hearted teenager.
Well, I just think that she's heard everything before. That's how I kind of take it. So kind of no matter which one of us is right in that regard, I just felt like it didn't matter. Like they've heard all of these responses before. And earlier in the episode, he tells Travis that, you know, he's going to get in rehab and he's going to clean up and he's going to go back. And Travis says, like, do you mean it? And he kind of smirkingly, Nick says back, I always mean it. And like, that's the kind of crap that's like, oh, like it just stabs in your heart. If you've ever dealt with anybody who has any type of addiction, that rings so true of the like, wow, that they do always mean it. They always mean that they're going to quit and they always mean they're going to, you know, do their best or whatever. And I felt like no matter what he was saying, whether he meant I'm going to quit this time to his sister or whether he was saying I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to quit bothering the family, it was like all had been heard before. So she's like, yeah, yeah, whatever.
Outside the hospital, Travis starts telling Maddie what he had seen at the church, and she's super dismissive about it. And in fact, we get some read on what kind of tactics she's willing to take.
Which I thought was super barfy. This is, again, like why she like plays dirty. I mean, he's been like in the hospital, you know, trying to take care of Nick, trying to allow her to get to work, trying to be there for the group, fixing things so that they don't have to spend money on it and all that kind of stuff. And then here he is kind of like pushing, not even arguing, but pushing her to like listen to another side. And she's like, just, I mean, oh yeah, you have problems with your own kid or whatever. Just, I don't like it. I don't like that kind of fighting. That's just nasty, underhanded. The next scene has us go back to school, and it seems like everyone's back now. So Alicia and Matt are having a conversation about this being just one more year till Alicia's out of there. And they make some plans later to meet up at the beach. And Matt's parents are not home. So clearly Miss Alicia is not exactly totally straight-laced. She's busy.
She may be smart academically,
right?
But
she's making some alternative plans.
Right.
And we also get a little glimpse into Travis's class. Mr. Manoa is his class. And he's talking about Jack London. And we get a little glimpse there. And we also are intercutting with the hospital at the same time.
The discussion that we're having in the class is custom made for a show about the fall of civilization to a zombie apocalypse, because it's getting at the heart of what a person is willing to do to survive. He's trying to discuss with one of the kids about a scene where a character cuts open a dog to put his hands inside the dog to keep his hands warm enough so that he can build a fire.
The kids are pretty dismissive of all this, like, that's psychotic, who would do something like that, whatever. And Travis pushes them and is like, yeah, but why? Why does he do that to the dog? And, you know, the kids again are sort of being like, I don't know, he's like, lame, whatever. And he's like, no, think about it, really think about it. And they answer, okay, well, he has to keep his hands warm in order to build the fire. And Travis pushes them more about why. And ultimately, it's to survive. The kids were so dismissive of, you know, what the man had to do in order to survive. And this was the big lesson that Travis wanted to teach them, that, you know, ultimately, it's man versus nature. And you have to figure out how you're going to survive.
On fearstorysync.com, there was a poll at that moment that said, what happens to this character? And after you vote, it's revealed this character freezes to death. Like, he wasn't willing to do what it took to survive, and he didn't. So as that's being revealed, Travis is telling us on screen, nature always wins. A question came to mind, like, is this nature that is that we are going up against here or something else?
Well, so that's a good question. So are they indicating then that whatever's gone on with the zombies is some sort of natural
occurrence
that has gone on? I'm not sure what, how that it could be, but if it is, and it's human man versus what they're considering some sort of natural change in society here,
right?
Sounds like we're going to lose.
Maybe, just maybe, we have the possible theological origin from the very beginning scene, and now we have just it's a fluke of evolution that mankind turns into zombies when they die from this point on.
And so we're going to ultimately kill ourselves, I guess. Right. Yeah, we're going to just die out.
The rest of the episode is pretty action-packed. The next scene is Nick's big escape from the hospital.
Yeah, I'd say like up to this point, we were like putting along at like 25 miles an hour. And it gets full on highway speed by the end of this episode.
Nick takes advantage of his ER mate's code blue, as they called it, to rip his bonds off, steal the old man's clothes, and run out while no one's looking.
Hey, you know what I realized just now? When the ER nurse like comes in to take care of Nick, she gives him a potty bowl thing, whatever, to go to the bathroom on. And he says, you know, I don't need to go right now. And she said, I take my dog out when I want him to go to the bathroom, not the other way around. And he says, in this situation, am I the dog? Which is crazy because that comes on the heels of the conversation with about Jack London and about cutting open the belly of the dog. And what are you willing to do to survive? And Nick straight says, am I the dog? And she's like, you're the dog.
Wow.
Boom.
Interesting. That's really a good
connection.
That
just flashed in my brain, people. That just hit me like lightning. So in the hubbub of the code blue, Nick grabs the other man's clothes and hightails it out of the hospital. He's looking so sad and decrepit because he's already this nasty, strung out, gross Edward Scissorhands wig. And then he is sporting this super old man's clothes. He's got a limp from the accident. So really, he looks deranged. He buys a cell phone with the money that he finds in the man's clothes. And he is calling somebody. We don't know who's on the other end of the line, and he just keeps insistently saying that he needs to get a hold of him. Meanwhile, we flip back over to Maddie and Travis, and they go to the church.
I think we get somewhere in there another drive-by of the park during one of these transit scenes.
We do. And this time it's very different, right?
It's a lot fewer kids.
I think there was almost nobody, right? There was a man that was under a tree. And there was like on the, they have kind of like these barricades kind of set up. And there was like some missing signs for look like a girl. But other than that, there's pretty much no one in the park, which is pretty weird because this is later in the day and they already showed this as like this bustling park.
Yeah.
On the fear sink at that moment, they actually zoomed in on the character, the man under the tree, and they kept him like in shadow and they put infected question mark.
Most people thought he was.
He looked weird. He was acting weird.
What happens at the church is Maddie gets a much better picture of what her son has been up to. She finds where he's been sleeping and she even finds a book that she recognizes as his amongst the mess.
It was worth it to look it up. The name of it was
Winesburg, Ohio.
So we looked it up, and the book was actually a collection of short stories, essentially focusing on individual characters on the backdrop of a larger story. So this is obviously very interesting because this is what we basically have between both Fear and Walking Dead. We basically have these moments where we focus in on one character and we kind of learn their story, but it's all going to be within the context of this much larger story. So I like that very much, actually, that they used that book. And I'm glad we got a chance to look it up.
She's sad because drugs fall out of the book.
Yeah, she opens it up like, oh, look, he brought his book. Like, he's such a good kid. And then, oh, a needle falls out.
They see nasty stuff at the church. And she just kind of writes it off as, well, violent stuff has happened here. I agree. Whether or not that has anything to do with what Nick told us, who knows? So let's keep looking, which reflects well on her. As brusque as she can be, she is not going to fold easily.
See, and I'm like opposite day. Like, it's funny that you're like as brusque as she can be. I'm like, okay, but Travis has told her, Nick has told her, like, there's really terrible stuff. And she's just still, she's acting like such a hardened, like I was saying, she has this, like, persona that comes off like she's this, like, special units, victim units, whatever, detective who's just seen it all and just whatever. Hello, she's a high school guidance counselor. She has not been involved in grisly murder scenes, we assume. She has not been involved in, like, serial killers, you know, cases or something. But she's acting like...
So she's a little cool for school for you.
Yeah, she's walking through a church where there's, like, blood stains and people's belongings. I mean, she should act more unnerved. And she acts sad that her son would choose to be in this surroundings and not at his own home.
See, in horror movies... The person that doesn't believe anything, they never survive.
Ooh.
You know, they don't get a pass. I mean, the person that never believes anything is like the one to be like, there's no problem out here. And then they open the door and then they get their head chopped off.
Head, right? Yeah. So do you have a theory on Madison? Do you feel like she has like a target on her back since she's got this kind of like non-believer?
I do. I do not believe Maddie is going to survive the... first season.
Really? Okay, so you think she's gonna die like season finale?
Yes. Or,
oh, so this is gonna set up a dynamic that we could probably assume would be Travis, Nick, Alicia, maybe boyfriend Matt, Lexi, I think was the name of the ex-wife, and then we think Chris is the name of Travis's son. So we think that might be the group.
Well, that leads into my second theory.
Oh, okay.
I think with all of the activity that Travis has put into trying to sort out Nick's story and the way that he blew off Chris, I think they're setting up a decision.
So you think there's going to be a Sophie's Choice moment where he is going to have to look at these two, maybe even with Lexi and Maddie looking on, and it's like truly like he has one hand to give and they're dangling from the cliff, and it's going to be Nick or Chris, and you think he's going to choose Nick?
Yes.
Intrigue. So we look forward to figuring that one out. So we continue on with old Maddie and Travis. They get through most of the church.
They decide to go question an old friend named Calvin, who they find outside vacuuming out a van used to transport someone in a wheelchair. Chris presents as a very clean-cut young man.
Cal presents as a, yeah, he seems like an upstanding guy. And the way that they kept being like, you look good, you look good. I just thought he was completely just like maybe definitely an old student. I thought maybe of Mr. Yeah. Manoa's, maybe who just was pals with Nick at some point in time. And even he calls her like Mrs. C, like that just seems very
yeah, you got the sense that if he hadn't been a student, then he had been to their house, you know, like that sort of familiar relationship. He indicated he didn't know anything about Nick, but he would help find them. And the next scene shows Nick unwrapping a prepaid cell phone and calling someone who we don't know who he's trying to call. And in the meantime, he's going to hang out under a bridge until he sorts that out.
Which is weird and sad. We get a quick little shot over to Alicia, who's like sitting around waiting for Matt to show up at the beach. And she keeps texting him and he's not showing up. I am feeling bad vibes about Matt. I definitely feel like he's gotten caught up in some zombie's teeth.
He's dinner.
I feel that way. The weirdest thing, though, in that scene that I thought was like so strange is they kept like kind of zooming in over at the... There was a van that was behind, sort of like on the street. And there was like a tarp or something that was over,
something that was
kind of hanging over the edge of the glass. I don't know. It was super weird because at first Paul didn't see it. And then I said, no, look, watch. And like on cue, the camera in the show like paused on the tarp, like, look here, Paul. And then like kept going. So I have no idea if that's actually going to lead to something. But that was certainly a strange moment in time. More interesting than the fact that Matt didn't show up was like, what are we looking at over here? Why do we keep looking at this stuff in the background? What is this?
You think maybe that was just to kind of give a little more texture, like this is where they live, this is how it is kind of thing?
What?
There are vans with tarps covering up the glass at the beach. Like, this isn't like...
No. Oh, no.
No?
No.
All right.
I think something like... I think it was like, I don't know, part of a dead body or part of something or I don't even know what. I really don't know. But no, I don't think it was to set the scene or the tone or whatever.
We catch up with Travis and Madison. They're in their pickup truck.
Hey, before we leave the church, my most favorite like actual line that Travis says when they're in the church is when he said that the bodies couldn't have just gotten up and walked away. I kind of love that part because it was so like for all fans who have been sitting here watching the zombie show, you're all kind of like, ugh. Like, did he just say that? You know, like, it's like next they're going to joke about having brains for dinner or something. You're like, oh.
So we catch up with Travis and Maddie. They're in their pickup truck on the highway. And Travis is doing everything he can. He's to say the right stuff. It was a lot like in Gilmore Girls when Luke is telling Lorelai that he would go and tie up Rory and bring her back to school to get her back on the straight and narrow path. And that's when...
Because he's just that committed to the family.
And Travis was basically saying the same stuff.
Yeah, he was absolutely saying the same exact stuff. And so as they're just like tooling along, I know this is California. We live in Texas, so we're not accustomed to this. But they're starting to get off on an exit, and there's just like a parking lot where they're just like sitting there at the exit. But they don't even pause in their conversation. Like, this was Paul and I'd be like, hold that thought. What the heck is going on here? The cars seem to be all stopped. What's going on? They continue to talk for like another minute or two before either one of them is like, there seems to be a problem. It is not until almost gunshots are fired that they're like, we should try another route.
Well, like, Maddie's actually like, what's going on? And Travis has a little stronger survival instinct. He's like, get in, we're going.
But it's like funny, wouldn't we have said, let's try another route? Even when we just came up on the scene of like 1,000 cars parked up in an area,
right.
We'd be like, let's take the next exit, okay? Like, we're just, I don't know, maybe again, like maybe in California, everybody's very, very used to traffic. And I understand that. So maybe it's just par for the course.
They squeal out of there. Next morning, we're outside the school. Principal Clark, or whatever his name is outside greeting kids as they come off the bus. And he's noting that there are very few kids getting off the bus. Come back inside and all the teachers are crowding around a TV watching the news. He comes over to check out what everyone is watching. And it is a scene that we start to recognize as the scene that Travis and Maddie were driving away from.
It appeared that there had been like a car accident and they had people on stretchers slash like those boards that are supposed to keep you like straight and for like a neck injury type thing. So they had the people like strapped down who appeared to have been in the accident. The EMTs were maybe even performing CPR or just checking vitals or whatever. And they were kind of leaned over. And the man who was on the stretcher board grabs a hold of the EMT and starts trying to bite on him.
And so there is a struggle, a fight. There are people trying to restrain the guy. And eventually it comes down to the police just opening fire on the guy. And it isn't until one of them registers a headshot after many, many, many shots to the body.
And like billy clubs to the body.
That he goes down. Maddie and Travis know the scene for what it is. Or more like they recognize it. And with everything that's been going on in their personal life, they see this in like a kind of a larger view. And they back out of the room and they decide to step up the search for Nick by calling the police. And here's kind of a weird part.
Maddie sets off to find Alicia in the classroom that Alicia is in, where she's also watching the footage on their phones with the other girls. And they're all deducing that this is all fake. This is some sort of weird YouTube video where people have set up some sort of fake thing. So the prevailing theory from the teenage world is this is all pretend.
At the same time that the principal is making a public address announcement that school has been cut short that day.
Which, when does that happen?
Maddie calls Alicia over to her and tells her that she wants her to go right home because she wants her there if Nick should come home. Now, to me and Caroline, this seemed like a what? kind of move.
Who has a situation where there's such an emergency that the district has decided to send the children home?
And the important thing to do is to separate.
Right. Is to go, right. You're at the school building with your child and you look at the child in the face and say, there's an emergency. Go get on the bus with the other kids and I'm going to get in my car. You're like, what? This did not ring true at all. I understand because we watched the episode several times over, so I understand why they needed to set up the next scene. Although for all in all intensive purposes, there's no reason why Alicia couldn't have been with them unless more stuff's going to happen in episode two. But the thing is that this is the dumbest thing I have ever heard. They're going to send their teenage daughter on the school bus. They're not even going to drive her to the house and drop her off. They are just going to take off in their own car. Even Travis is like, hey, let's hurry up so we don't get blocked in. Like, they're not like, hey, let's make sure the kids get on the buses or anything. Like, they're just like, hey, let's head on out.
And Alicia's just going to hold down the fort because she's been a part of the program so far.
Right. She's been Johnny on the spot for assistance.
On the way out of the school, Maddie does notice Tobias with his sad panda face staring out of a school bus. And she waves and he just
looks away in disgust because this is the moment that Tobias had freaking warned her about and said, like, hey, this is what I'm scared about. I'm bringing like a weapon with me to school in case something breaks out. And she's all like, hey, Tobias, have a good day. And she's like, hey, jerk lady, we're getting out of school because of the zombie apocalypse. And you're all like, have a good day, kids. Like, oh, poor Tobias. I'm with him. If I were him, I'm like, really? I don't know why he didn't. I'm being honest with you. I don't know why he didn't flip her off, really, honestly.
We catch up with Nick coming into a cafe where he takes his time and he eventually comes over to a young man who looks like Cal, but doesn't look like the Cal that we met before. And he's immediately apologizing. And we begin to understand that Cal plays two roles. One is at his grandmother's house where the van with the wheelchair is. He is a nice guy who you can bring home to mom. But in reality, he is Nick's drug dealer. And they are having a discussion about the fact that Nick's parents came to his grandma's house looking for him and how Cal can't have that. They come to an agreement where Nick is immediately going back on anything that he ever that promised about cutting out drugs from now on. He doesn't mean it anymore, apparently, because he is asking Cal for more drugs to scrub his mind of what he thinks he saw.
And that's why I am going with my theory that when he said he's going to end it, I don't think it meant end his relationship with drugs in any form or fashion. Either end it, like formally sever his ties with the family, like go to the other end of the earth and just stay away forever and stop dipping back into their lives, or take so much drugs that he overdoses. So I'm kind of sticking with that. But I was super surprised. That was a small reveal, but they did present Cal in a very helpful, happy, you know, young adult kind of way. So then to see him in the Denny's or whatever they were in, you know, giving him the, you know, you've gone against the grain, son, kind of lecture that, I mean, I felt nervous right away. And clearly Nick acted like
he knew he was in trouble.
Oh my God. He was like completely panicking. So they go for a drive.
On the way out to the car, we see more Nick in slow motion. I don't know why that's important, except why would they use it? It wasn't even an action scene. They were just walking from a cafe to a car. I think it's just more something about Nick in slow motion. Anyway, we are in Cal's car for a while, and we pull into what Caroline identified as Thunder Row from Greece. Where they pull off the race at the end of Greece. And if it's not the same place, then I guess LA just has a lot of places like that.
And also, don't they go through the same thing in Terminator? Aren't they down in that exact same type?
It looks like, yes, where like, they in Terminator 2, where they have the chase scene.
Okay, so I kept comparing Maddie, the mom, to like Sarah Connor. Maybe it's because I had the same Maybe I was vibing off of this Terminator setting at the end here. I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know. I'm just saying that they have already, I feel like costuming has already put Maddie in some sort of Rambo gear and decided like, yes, you look good in this. And then let's work backwards from there and try to make you.
She's not particularly feminine looking in whatever she.
So let's work backwards from there and try to make you a mom. And like, they just like didn't get there at all, at all.
You don't need to be a well-seasoned zombie movie or any kind of movie watcher to know that when your drug dealer takes you to a remote place, he's not going there to show you like his best, newest stuff. He's probably there to kill you. Nick comes to that same conclusion, but he has to see the gun first.
He's not as fast as everybody else.
I don't know what Cal was expecting when he asked him to get out of the car and he was holding a gun. Like, are we going to play with guns now? What's going on? No, he just like, yeah, I'll take an honorable death. Thank you. I do have it coming. Anyway, he struggled for the gun and with the same kind of ferocity that we saw Nick display in the run at the beginning of the episode, he overpowers Cal, and
which is kind of crazy,
and manages to gut shoot Cal and run away.
I was surprised that he managed to wrestle the gun in any form or fashion. But at the same time, I don't know. I think you're right. There's something about the slow-mo and something about these like bursts of energy that are clearly going to be what keeps him alive.
Even though he's got his problems with drugs, he's got an underlying steel there, I guess. Like it or not, he might be the hero of this show. Caroline's pointed out, why in the world, if all the names they could pick, why would they choose Nick when they already have a hero named Rick in the other show? It's just kind of this
weird
coincidence. That
I don't
just
think it's a coincidence, but I do think it's weird. Maybe they found that it's that short names are easy to yell or something, but we have Maddie and Maggie, Rick and Nick. Like, we got, there's just like a lot of like, blah.
Travis and Blavis.
Shut up.
We find Nick waiting under a bridge and the pickup truck pulls up with Travis and Maddie, and he begins to object to Maddie being there, but whatever, she's there, he's got to deal with it, and he starts telling them, I did a bad thing, and he wants to admit right away that he's killed Cal, and he doesn't really know what to do with himself at this point. Since Maddie hasn't believed anything he has said so far this episode, she needs to see what has happened with her own eyes. So they all get in the truck, and they go to the spot where Calvin should be. Down at Thunder Row, we get out of the truck and walk over to Cal's car. And guess what? No Cal. Just blood on the ground, but nothing to indicate where he is. And that makes it that much harder for Maddie and Travis to believe him. So they pile back in the truck and start to reverse down this little chute that they had to use to get there. Lurching along behind them, they see a form that they recognize as Cal. Maddie and Travis get out to check it out, and Cal begins to attack them. A man of action, all of a sudden, Nick slams the truck into reverse.
I thought it was smart, it was good.
And plows over Cal, who didn't take enough of a shock to the head, apparently, because he just gets back up. Bonus points for Travis and Maddie for getting out of the way. Good on them. They stay out of the way, and Nick revs the engine again and plows over Cal with the front of the truck, except this time he kind of catches him with the hood, and he flings him off by hitting the brakes after getting up some speed.
That was so gross.
And his body just kind of crumples after hitting the ground. And everyone gets out to come see what
Travis and everyone. I mean, happened. Can you imagine what like, okay, now your drug addled son's brain has now just like run over what you think is like perhaps just a injured friend of the family that you've like brought into this situation, and then now you witness your son like take off and plow him over, and then like the guy tries to attack you and everything. Oh my God. I can't even imagine. I can't imagine. But to me, neither Maddie nor Travis, Nick was the one who was acting the most freaked out and the most like acting like we're under attack. Travis and Maddie to me were acting like
dazed.
Yeah. And like a, you two are going to die in this apocalypse. If that is your response when something's happening. And I know Nick has had, you know, like one or two more days ahead of them of being into this thing. But I mean, crap, they better like get up to speed here that you need to respond. You can't just walk over and be all like, hey, I wonder what happened. Like,
we close out with Cal's body making the zombie seething noise that we've come to recognize from the original show. And the camera pans back from Thunder Row to show downtown LA off in the distance and a train running, which I thought was interesting to leave in the shot because like in the original show, when we see Atlanta, all of that kind of stuff is not there. We're showing the closing moments, basically, of society.
So overall, how did you feel? Do you have any theories of where the show is going, moving on?
Maybe I was distracted with the live tweeting and the story sync, but I did not feel the kind of suspense that I would have expected.
I guess on one hand, I know if this is going to be a series that is supposed to be before it really happens, then, I mean, there has to be some mundane, just normal, go to work, deal with your regular life kind of stuff. Because if they don't set that scene, then they really aren't getting us to before the incidents happen, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess we have to have that. But as viewers, even understanding that we have to have those kind of like, ho-hum, do your homework, go to work, deal with kids kind of stuff in order to feel like fearful or whatever when bad stuff happens. I'm glad that there's zombies in the very first episode and we go right there because I was...
My God, if there weren't any...
Well, but there could have been a lot more if you think about it.
Some innuendo, had, you mean? Like bodies found?
But... Yeah, we could have had more of the exact scene that I thought actually played out perfectly was the whole exit on the highway scene. And then the kids watching it later on TV and like and watching it later on YouTube or whatever. That kind of stuff, like to me, is the perfect like campfire horror story, lingers in your mind. You didn't really see it. And like Tobias said, there'd only been reports in 5 states. That's hardly enough to make it reasonable that they would have a friend turn into a zombie, you know? And so it's sort of like they actually could have built it up a lot more nationwide. There could have been a whole lot more of these, you know, near misses, the pulling up on a scene, not really knowing what's going on, and some government cover up even, because, I mean, they already know it's true. They already know something, or at least something way, way, way more real is happening. Because, I mean, it basically ends with them saying, what is happening? So they already know there's, like, a problem. Now, maybe we will be given some sort of cover-up by the government. Maybe there will be something that comes out. But kids are already not going to school. They're already, like, right from the halfway through the episode, there was 5 kids on the school bus. I'm not sure. Like, I actually could have done with, you're right, more suspense techniques, more... I don't know what else to say.
Well, I think our problem was that the more we think about it, the more we see that this show is probably about Nick. And we don't really like Nick. I mean, the other show starts with Rick. And that show is about Rick.
And we like Rick.
And the guy that's running this show ran Sons of Anarchy before. And that show was about Jax. And Jax is a highly imperfect hero. You know, he was a gang leader who had easy sex and did drugs whenever he needed to and killed people when he had to, but was still kind of this charismatic guy that was the leading man.
But that's the part that I'm feeling like I'm missing with kind of all of them. Like, I don't feel like Maddie, Travis, Nick, or Alicia has any charisma. None of them am I drawn to as like, hey, you're the guy I want to root for. I want to root for Travis just because he seems like he has a good heart and he seems like he's really trying. But
not from Chris's perspective.
Okay, good call. Really good call. So he's really trying on one side, but you're right. You're totally right. He's kind of abandoning his fatherly duties on the other side, which stinks, and that shouldn't be that way. So then I don't even know. There's like nobody to root for, which you're right. Right from the get-go of Walking Dead, the second Rick woke up, we were rooting for him. In Lost, the second Jack's eyes opened, we're rooting for Jack. You know, we want them to be okay. It's like there's so many people that normally when you start off a show, you can find somebody that you feel like this is the guy I want to root for. Now, maybe we're going to see some fantastic come to Jesus moment for Nick where he realizes that this is his Jack London, whatever. The problem I have is he wasn't in that classroom. It's not even like tied in with him. That those themes and stuff, it's not like all of a sudden the lessons of life are going to come to him. Like, it's been established.
He might be a very frustrating guy to follow because he's going to have this monkey on his back.
He can't be a leader.
Right. But that's kind of the position, just kind of story-wise, I kind of assume at this point he's being positioned for.
You don't think it's Travis?
No. I think Travis is going to be a major character. But
is he like Travis the Shane?
Well, it's funny, but he might be more like the Daryl, because Daryl was always supportive.
Well, this is a weird dynamic because, I mean, we're very familiar with characterization of different men where we have like the Dale, the sort of wise, you know, old
cynic,
or the Herschel, the like, you know, has the answers, has lived some life. You know, whatever.
Doesn't want to lead, but is very valuable to have around.
Very valuable. Yeah, absolutely. He's like the medicine man to turn to. You know, we have these other characters, the Daryl, who's kind of like this rogue guy, but he's dependable for being what he is. You know, he's going to go trap food. He's going to go find supplies, whatever. Same with Glenn. Like, he's kind of the more, I want to think, like, he's the guy who can, like, squeeze through small holes kind of guy. Like, he's the guy who's going to come up with the unusual way to sort of get their supplies.
Well, Daryl can't lead. Where Glenn can, he just kind of needs a little more years on him.
Which is what scares me about Nick being any type of actual leader. Like, I don't know how we could possibly get behind him in any form or fashion. Now, here's the thing. Maybe we're overlooking the obvious. Here we are just talking about men. Maybe Maddie's the leader. Maybe this is going to be a matriarchal group. Whereas we have...
I think it will be up until she gets killed.
Oh, you beast. Well, I honestly think maybe this is going to be totally woman-led. And I mean, they've put Maddie in the position of being sort of the... I don't want to say where's the pants in the family, but between her and Travis, it really seems like, you know, he really wants to make her happy. She doesn't really seem to care about making him happy, like it or not, you know?
No.
He does not, huh?
No.
So what do you make of that?
Travis is trying hard. Maddie is very caught up in her own business and is accepting of Travis's
Yeah, like just
overtures.
Accepting of his help, but like not actually doing much in return. I don't know. It's a little bit of a mystery there. But it is a little intriguing to think that if she is the Sarah Connor type, if she is the figure that is going to lead. And then maybe she isn't going to make it long, but maybe since they've already said Alicia's smart and, you know, she can do all this stuff, maybe she is the young woman leader that comes out on the other side. Because on the flip, on Walking, we have a lot of men, older and younger, who have taken very strong leadership roles. In fact, it would be difficult to even categorize some of the other women who have come and gone as to where they even fit in exactly. They've just kind of, they've very much been additional characters, but they don't have a clear-cut role.
We kind of have talked about that this show seems designed to address the various racial and gender shortcomings that critics have taken with the first show.
That is one thing that Paul and I did a little reading on, because when it said that it was out in LA, we wanted to do a little reading up as to the diversity of the group and why maybe they would have chosen to go out to California. And that is a huge complaint that we saw over and over that came up that said there's not enough strong women, there's not enough strong minorities. You know, you have like one black guy who comes on for 2 seconds. Now, given so far, and fear, there's not so good. But Travis's last name is Manoa, so he obviously is not completely just Anglo. And he has, if Chris and Lexi come into the scene, they seem like they are also not Caucasian. So there does seem like there's at least some other diversity there. So maybe they're trying to address some of that. The thing for me that it would be nice is it would be nice if some of that actually played out. Like, because they have these other ethnicities, maybe they have different superstitions, different stories that have passed down in their family that may be a little different than the standard white bread America stories or something. Something that would give them a little bit more
perspective.
Yeah, just something different. I mean, every once in a while, there's a story where someone does come from a different background. And because of that, they have more skills or they're more prepared to handle the information than just the standard straight down the middle white guy who just hasn't really had any newer different things. Sometimes they know how to handle, you know, maybe if someone's from an island country or something where maybe their heritage had used berries and roots and stuff like that for health reasons or things like this, then I know for certainty that might come into play. But they're still playing them off as being pretty just middle class, kind of white despite the color of their skin kind of people. Like, I mean, I'm not cutting any other read thus far. I hope that they do actually use it to come up with something else here. One thing that you had pointed out, Paul, earlier is we've heard nothing about Alicia and Nick's dad. So he still has the potential to come on the scene as a character.
As a huge wild card.
Yeah, I mean, he could be the guns a-blazing He-Man to come in on the scene. Somebody had to put up with Maddie.
She is not the sort that would have had a very marshmallowy kind of...
Unless you're Travis.
Well...
I think first husband was a hard ass. That's what I think. I think that second husband's going to be the pushover. I think it's just the yin and the yang. So I think if we do go locate ex-husband, I think he is going to be a force to be reckoned with, my opinion.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what is to come. There's only 6 episodes in this first season of Fear the Walking Dead, so they've got to get their whole story arc done in the next 5 episodes.
That's true. It's going to be fast. So hopefully that means we're going to see a lot of characters come in and go in. That means that maybe Maddie's going to be saying her swan song sooner than we thought if Paul gets his wish come true over there. So it'll be super exciting. If you are listening out there, we really encourage you to check out Fear on DVR. If you DVR'd it, check out Fear Sync Up when it comes on. It's fearsync.com.
I think it's fearstorysync.com.
Fearstorysync.com. Check it out because we really found that there was a lot of information there and it's really a different way to experience the show. And also head on over to our other podcasts and listen to The Leftovers. You can catch up on that. You can binge watch that, the entire season 1, before season 2 starts up in October.
You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We're Daily Review on both of those. We live tweeted the pilot episode, and we'll probably keep that up for future episodes that we are reviewing. So until next time.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.